It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here to go all propeller head on breaking through Apple's NAND flash. Is it proprietary? You're going to find out. Google shames the internet into being more secure. ICANN says goodbye to IANA and hello to DNSSEC and DANE. And cross-site scripting. It's the adventure of GRC.com. Security Now is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 578, recorded September 20th, 2016. GRC's Cross-Site Scripting Adventure. This episode of Security Now is brought to you by Braintree. Mobile app development can be complex, but integrating your payments no longer has to be. With Braintree, your business can accept nearly every type of payment from any device with just one integration. Learn more at BraintreePayments.com/SecurityNow. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century with a fast, easy, and completely online process. Check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/securitynow. It's time for Security Now, the most secure show on the internet, where we are guided through the security issues, software updates, and coding conundrums by our explainer-in-chief, Mr. Steve Gibson, of course, from GRC.com. Steve, it's so good to be working with you again.
Father Robert, it is absolutely a joy. I was thinking last week, I was hearing Leo already, even though he hadn't left yet, bemoaning the fact that he had to be back in 2.5 weeks. And I'm thinking, okay, wait. So we've been hearing about this vacation for the last 6 months. Now, as you're getting ready to go, you're worried about having to come home too soon. So the good news is, I think that in the future, you and I will have probably more opportunities like this to do the podcast together.
And you know what, Steve? I think that's actually healthy. That's the whole idea, that he's getting used to the good life. You know, he's worked really hard to build this thing up, and it's time for him to actually enjoy. And I got to say, after going on a vacation for, you know, a month, if you've ever done one of those, these little 2-3 day vacations just don't mean much anymore.
Right. It takes a while to disconnect, and then, you know, you're not in a hurry to reconnect.
Yeah, that's so true. And I've got a Jesuit analogy for that, an analog, actually. It's when we go on retreat, so we disconnect for at least 8 days a year. And by disconnect, I mean really disconnect. There's no internet.
Are you allowed to talk?
Some of us, you are allowed to talk, but most of us don't. It's just this, it's the sort of, you give yourself permission to just be introspective. But it does take a good day to 3 days for you to get into that mode. And it's the same thing for vacation. So, but we're not going to do that, Steve. What we're doing is we're going the other way. We're going to go full steam ahead. We're going to look at some very interesting security issues that have been popping up over the world.
So, yeah, we've got, this is going to be a fun podcast. I haven't mentioned this at all, but there was an event a couple of weeks ago that unfortunately distracted me in an unexpected fashion, when a security researcher reported an unknown cross-site scripting vulnerability on GRC. So the adventure that ensued resulted in my, first of all, looking for a way to determine what the problem was. I looked at three site security scanners, and one of the three stood out and has become the formally recommended terrific solution that I'll be talking about. And then I'm also going to talk about what it found, and which is interesting, because we've glanced over cross-site scripting problems, but this is a perfect opportunity to dig in a little bit further. But there's also a bunch of other news. We're going to talk about the concerns over the significant expansion in what is effectively warrantless intrusion into end-user computers, which, unless Congress acts to block it, will automatically take effect at the beginning of the year. There's also a forthcoming change in internet governance, which is causing some controversy, I think largely due to misunderstanding what it is and what it means. There's a new DNSSEC root signing key on the way. Google has moved further, or is continuing to move, in its push for improved browser security. Well, web security, using its the power, the marketing power, essentially, of its browser in order to force change. And, you know, that's always been controversial because they're regarded as being rather, you know, strong-armed, but it's being effective. And then we got some really interesting details from an individual who successfully cloned the EEPROM, the NAND memory, in an iPhone 5C, which was the target, of course, of the San Bernardino issue, the FBI wanting Apple to decrypt the phone and so forth. And the write-up is fascinating because it gives us, first of all, proves that it's possible to use that theoretical technique, which had been proposed, but there's some surprising things hidden in the details. And we have a little bit of miscellany, and then we're going to talk about cross-site scripting as it happened on GRC.
Wow. You know, I guess there really must not have been much going on, because we're only talking about an intimate look at cross-site scripting, about how the government's getting more spying powers, about how the iPhone has been broken into, and of course how the governance of the internet's going to change. So I guess it was a slow week.
Yeah, well, we try to scrape some things together to talk about.
We're going to get to all of that action in just a bit. But before we do it, you know, because we want to be responsible hosts, we want to make sure that this show carries on into the future, let's take a moment to thank the sponsor of this episode of Security Now. Now, let me ask you something. When you are a developer, when you create things, when you put them out onto the internet, be it a service or an app or the next great thing, do you eventually want to get paid? I mean, of course you do. I mean, even if you're doing it out of the goodness of your heart, even if you want people just to see your work, at some point you're going to have to figure out, how do I monetize this so I can continue doing the good work? Well, if this was 10 years ago, you'd have to set up your own financial transaction server. You'd have to make an agreement with the financial processor. You'd probably have to get someone to hire so that they can maintain the equipment, because, I mean, if you're dealing with financial information, you definitely don't want that to breach. Yeah, you could do all that, along with getting space in a colo and making sure that your hardware is up to date, or you could just use Braintree, the easiest way for you to add payments to your app or your service. Now, Braintree allows you to accept everything from pounds to PayPal to the next big innovation. Because they're a full-stack payment platform, it's easily adaptable to whatever the future holds, and that means that you can adapt too. And when that new payment method comes along, be it a new cryptocurrency or a new way to pay from one of the major phone manufacturers, you know that Braintree will be there to support you, to give you that new integration as soon as it comes out. All you have to do is update a few lines of code. What does this mean for you? Well, it means no late nights, no complicated recoding, no stress about staying ahead of the curve. Braintree Payments is here to help. And the way that they help you is to help you concentrate on the coding that you want to do, not the coding that you need to do for financial transactions. Braintree gives you a simple, secure payment solution, code that you can integrate quickly. It supports Android, iOS, and JavaScript clients. They have an SDK in 7 languages, .NET, Node.js, Java, Perl, PHP, Python, and Ruby. It's elegant code with clear documentation. Really, it's code for people who code. So here's what we want you to do. If you are working too hard to accept payments, stop it. Instead, try Braintree. Braintree gives you an easy way to accept multiple payment types with one integration. Integrating it into your app is as easy as inserting a few lines of code. Learn more today at BraintreePayments.com/securitynow. That's BraintreePayments.com/securitynow. And we thank Braintree Payments for their support of Security Now. All right, Steve, set us loose on this wonderful, wonderful amendment to Rule 41, because this... At first glance, it seems a little scary.
Well, so what's most upsetting about this? But then we'll talk about what these amendments are. But the thing that's most annoying is that an obscure process was apparently deliberately used to cause this change to occur unless Congress acted to block the change. So as we know, the way the U.S. legislative process works is Congress creates, is supposed to be the creator of laws, which are then voted on typically in the House and the Senate. Then if there are differences in those bills, then they try to pull them together and ratify them into a single one in a conference. So the concern here is that Congress had no role in writing or approving these changes. They were developed within the U.S. court system through what was described as an obscure procedural process. Okay, so what happens is this proposal or these changes will automatically go into effect on December 1st. That is the last month of this year, which doesn't also give us much time. There's just six more working weeks until the Senate recesses, and there's a long to-do list of other things that have to happen. What the rules essentially make lawful is the government's and law and governmental law enforcement's ability to hack any number of computers, I mean like millions or more, with a single warrant. So the government says it needs this power to investigate, for example, botnets. As we know so well, networks of devices which are infected with malware and controlled by a criminal. But these are typically innocent victims' machines. And I talked about this years ago on the podcast. I was involved in a big conference call with like the person in the government, like the DOJ person. I don't remember now who she was. I want to say Jennifer Granholm, but I don't think that's the case. But it was somebody way up and a group of people who were involved. This was back in the Code Red and NIMDA days where innocent Windows machines had been infected by this worm and were then perpetuating that infection, were out scanning the internet independently in order to find targets. And this discussion we had, the security researchers sort of on our side were saying, is it not possible for a white hat hacker to fix these machines? That is, we knew the IP addresses because they were non-spoofed TCP connections. So we had a list of the infected machines, and they had essentially an open back door, which is how they got infected. That same back door, that is that same flaw in Windows back then, could be exploited to remove the bad thing. And this was like half of the conference call was discussing the legality and unfortunately the illegality of doing that. It is absolutely against the law, even for the best of reasons, for a system to be modified without its owner's permission. That's what this changes. This essentially is what the government has been wanting, what law enforcement has been wanting, they would say needing, for quite a while. And you know, we all feel victims from time to time, depending upon who's being DDoSed or attacked, of networks of autonomous slave computers. So essentially what this does is it changes that from being illegal to being legal in a very broad way. Essentially, it represents, in fact, Wired Magazine editorializing said, this kind of vast expansion of government mass hacking and surveillance is clearly a policy decision. This is a job for Congress, not a little-known court process. If Congress had to pass a bill to enact these changes, it almost certainly would not pass as written. The Justice Department may need new authorities to identify and search anonymous computers linked to digital crimes. But this package of changes is far too broad, with far too little oversight or protections against collateral damage. And the biggest thing this changes is it allows a warrant to be issued by a court, which then grants search and penetration right to the requesting agency, essentially irrespective of jurisdiction. There always we have traditionally had jurisdictional boundaries such that that a magistrate was only able to issue a warrant for a specific jurisdiction, something that they controlled. This removes that limitation, and you can understand, like, you know, the internet is global. We've got computers all over the place. You can see how they want this, but this is a big change. And again, I don't think anybody would have a problem if it was well argued and thought through in committee by Congress. Ron Wyden is screaming at the top of his lungs, trying to keep this from happening, saying, you know, this has to be stopped. This is far too broad. The language is too permissive. And so the concern is that this is sort of happened without it's happened without our normal process of figuring out, is this something we want to do? Look at the problem we've had with net neutrality that refuses to go away, despite the fact that we keep deciding, you know, how it should be. But people, you know, powerful entities don't want it to be that way. So it never seems to go to bed. And now we have something sort of similar. Essentially, this does allow the FBI to implant malware in, that is, their own software, in a machine that they believe they have reasonable cause to do so with, like it scanned somebody or it sent a probe somewhere. It's a big change. And I wouldn't argue that we don't need to discuss solutions to this problem, but, you know, like having ISPs prevent spoofing of their own addresses in packets that egress their network would be a nice, simple, technical first step to take, rather than immediately saying, oh, the only solution is to let the law enforcement do anything they want.
You know, Steve, I'm with you. And I understand that this is one of these law of unintended consequences where I see the problem that they're trying to solve. I understand how they're trying to legislatively deal with it. And yet I can very easily see how this could be abused and how this could lead to horrible, horrible secondary effects. But let's be fair. I'm going to play devil's advocate. I don't think the law should be as it currently is. But if I'm law enforcement, I could make a good case for saying, look, we need to update the warrant process because it's so difficult to know where a perpetrator might be operating out of. They may have servers in all 50 different states. They may have servers outside of the country. And I cannot, in my investigation, wait for a warrant for every jurisdiction that a mail packet may have passed through. And so this is essentially giving me the authority to track down the bad guys where the bad guys actually live. What would be your answer to that? I mean, how would if you had a law enforcement officer come to you and say, what's the better way to do this? What would your answer be?
I don't have one. Mm-hmm. I mean, the other interesting thing is that, you know, cyber warfare is becoming a bigger issue. I mean, it's like it's on the radar now. The politicians are talking about it. It's moved from sci-fi into reality in a like with chilling speed. And so there are two sides to this. There is, you know, might this be itself a backdoor into a lot, providing a means by which the U.S. government would have the legal authority, A, to to reach into attacking machines and deal with them, or B, to commandeer IP-connected bandwidth generators, which is what our machines are these days, and rally them for them for an attack.
You know, the interesting part about that is I could understand the law enforcement mentality that says, okay, this server is generating bad packets, so we're going to confiscate it. We're physically going to go and take it away so that we can analyze it and find out where the attacks were coming from. But that's not how the internet works anymore. I mean, if you're running a service somewhere on the internet, most likely you're on a shared box. You're a virtualized machine. Right. So there's nothing that Ellie can take without disrupting what is most likely dozens of other completely legal, completely legitimate traffic sources.
And we've seen stories of that.
I mean, yes, we have.
The FBI has gone in and yanked out racks that had completely unrelated domains that just disappeared because, you know, there was one bad guy among them.
Right. And in fact, during the mega upload debacle, when the DOJ actually physically took servers, there were people who were not hosting pirated content, did not have copyright content, but it was a multi-year fight for them to get the data off the hard drives, because essentially the DOJ was saying, you need to prove to us that you own the data that you own. And they're saying, wait a minute, how are we going to do that? Our ownership was the hardware. You took the hardware. I don't know.
Yeah, I am. There was I don't know how long ago it was. It was maybe more than a decade ago. There was a relatively mild attack on GRC that was not using spoofed packets. It might have just been ICMP flood. But I captured the traffic and looked at it and then wrote a little Perl script to run a quick reverse DNS through the entire block of IPs. And I found four that were oc.oc.cox.net. Well, that was clearly, that was you know, my own reverse DNS. That was Orange County Cox Cable. And so I contacted some local friends at the FBI, and I said, hey, I've got four IPs belonging, I'm sure, to some people who don't know their home PCs are infected with some malware. Is there any way you could contact them and arrange for me to get permission to take a look at them? And as it happens, my relationship was strong, and they were able to get a hold of one of the families I gave them the IPs because I didn't know who they belonged to. They asked Cox for the physical real world identities of these families after opening a case to make this legal, and contacted the families. One of them was only a couple miles away. I drove over and found the bot that was attacking me. And of course, that was part of the process of unwinding the mystery of the very early attacks that by some hacker named Wicked that the GRC underwent. So, you know, that's an example of the way it's being done today. I was only able to do that because I have that kind of working relationship with law enforcement that made it possible. So, no, not everybody can do that, and they wouldn't know what to do with the information probably if they had it. But still, it involved, you know, a lot of real world interaction with the court system, with the bandwidth provider, with the victims of the attack, and getting their permission to allow a non-law enforcement security researcher to make a house call. And so, you know, it worked, but it doesn't scale. And I think this feels to me like at scale issue. That is, all of this is getting bigger, attacks are getting stronger, and existing tools that were designed for the physical world are failing the cyber world. So, I mean, I can absolutely see both sides of it too. My only, I guess the only problem is this didn't have any oversight. This was clearly the only reason these amendments happened. And this, by the way, is in a, it's like an obscure rule in something that was completely unrelated to this, literally just slipped in, was to avoid this process. Now, maybe the it's a problem that something as broad as necessary could not get passed, but that's the way the system works. And it seems wrong to arbitrarily bypass it if that's, you know, if some people's interests are to do so. That's not a democracy.
Right. And unfortunately, I think we're just in this very scary part. And we've known this. We've talked about this on multiple shows on Twit TV, where law is so far behind where we live in the virtual world that when they try to apply law that was built for the physical world, it always ends up breaking something, or it always ends up just looking foolish, ham-handed. We've got people in the chat room like Eric Duckman and the like who are saying, you know, it's easy to say that you're against this because, of course, there's going to be unintended consequences. But it's more difficult to say, okay, well, then what is the solution? What do we do? If you don't want to do it that way and you admit that we need this authority, we need the ability to reach into a box that is generating mal packets, that is owned, especially a box that let's take your example. You were lucky enough to have a relationship with law enforcement. You were lucky enough to have an IT administrator who was willing to let you in and fix what was wrong with his gear.
Oh, his team, the two teams there were very happy because their big problem was they could no longer record pirated CDs because the computer was so busy attacking things that the CD burner no longer worked.
We're trying to do our illegal things.
My music. I don't have my music. It's like, oh, okay. Well, that's got our priorities straight.
No, but I mean, even in your case, that was someone you could work with. There are so many servers that have been compromised on the internet that have been abandoned for 10 years, and they will never get patched, and they will never be looked at because someone spun them up a while ago and forgot about them. And you know, what do you do about that when there is no contact person, when it's paid for the next 5 years and it's just going to spin at the bottom of that rack, but it is completely useless and generating traffic across the net? And so I think all of us understand that there needs to be something, some provision to allow us to fix that. But I think you're right. It's just the lack of oversight really does. It makes this feel like the FISA court again.
You asked me, you posed the theoretical problem. What could we do? An interesting compromise is service termination. That is, just disconnect the bandwidth to that malfunctioning machine. So it's no longer able to contaminate the shared resource that is the global internet. If somebody then is behind it, who's trying to send letters to their mother, and suddenly their internet goes down, then they contact their ISP and say, "Hey, I don't have any connectivity." The ISP says, "No, we had to shut you off because you've got malware in your machine," and then thereby get permission to proceed. So maybe just cutting the cord of these things, of these machines that are misbehaving. Again, it's not a perfect solution and it is subject to abuse, but it's a midway between doing nothing and actively having a court issue a warrant that gives global rights to law enforcement to do what they cannot do today.
Steve, there is one more provision in this rule change that we haven't yet talked about. And that is, this is interesting because it does sound like a lawmaker was trying to be responsible, that there is at least the mention that the best effort must be made to inform the owner of a server that it's been searched. I'm not sure if that was just tacked in at the end or if that was the original intent of the bill to make the seam balanced. That's not enough oversight, though, because, I mean, it's the language is, well, I mean, you should try to make your best effort, but we're not actually going to hold you to it.
It's very open to interpretation.
Yeah. So in other words.
And, Edward Snowden has shaken our confidence, I think, in an important way. And as a consequence, we view what is being done on our behalf with a little more skepticism than we did before, when things were theoretical but were assumed not to be happening. Now we keep seeing conspicuous, I think, evidence of what appears to be deliberate manipulation of equipment across the industry, all aimed at essentially, I mean, and this is illegal manipulation. You know, Cisco didn't give anyone permission to crack into their routers using previously unknown SNMP flaws. Yet we have evidence that that's been going on, and probably from some of the government bodies.
You know, 2 years back at Black Hat, Dan Geer, the keynote speaker, was saying how he thought that governments should be responsible for buying up 0 days and then sharing them. They're the only entity that has the resources to be able to find these and then secure internet infrastructure. But it seems more that the governments are buying up 0 days and then using them.
Yeah.
Yay. All right. You know what? Let's go on to something that I consider to be a related topic, because you just mentioned how our confidence in government organizations has really sunk to a low.
Eroded.
Eroded is big gentle. It was washed away completely. And even now, even the smallest mention of something that happens in the dark or without oversight just raises all sorts of red flags.
Well, even something that's being changed. It's like, well, do we really have to change anything? So, okay, this is the way I put the show notes together, it was with as a bit of an acronym glossary, because this is a little bit of acronym soup. The headline I put on this is NTIA's contract with ICANN to handle IANA is expiring in 10 days. So we've never really on this show looked at the bureaucracy of the internet. That is, you know, the behind the technology mechanisms, which are important, but they're such a mess that I just rather talk about bits and bytes and protocol numbers rather than, you know, the politics of it. But there is politics. So the IANA, that's the Internet Assigned Numbers Authority, and of course that includes DNS. That's the group, the body which manages the DNS route and two top-level domains, INT and ARPA. It coordinates the global pool of IP and AS. That's the autonomous system numbers. Those are the numbers that large ISPs are given, that BGP routers use for moving bulk data between, you know, top-level networks. And they maintain internet protocol assignments. So we don't normally, you know, our normal use of the internet only encounters that a little bit. That is the IANA work. But down at the packet level, for example, an IP packet has a header field that identifies the protocol like UDP or TCP or ICMP that is carried by that IP wrapper packet. Well, those protocols are identified by a number. Who decides what that number is? Who sets that number? That's the job of the IANA. And so their job is crucial. The only thing that allows the level of interconnectivity that we have is an agreement about protocols, and you have to have an enumeration of stuff that within the protocol, like which, you know, sub protocol of IP you're talking about, and so on. So the Internet Assigned Numbers Authority, like the name sounds, manages, you know, those sort of static definitions for the internet. Okay, now ICANN, I-C-A-N-N, is the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. Now, that's already today a multinational, multi-stakeholder body. It happens to be based here in Southern California in Los Angeles. And it is composed of many member countries, including China and Russia. So that it's already multinational in nature. And while the internet has been growing and happening, ICANN has managed the IANA functions, which are technically its responsibility. So ICANN has been managing or providing these internet assigned numbers authority functions under a contract with the Commerce Department's NTIA. That's the National Telecommunications and Information Administration. However, the United States has long made clear that it intended to eventually privatize the domain name system in order to, that is, sort of to release implicit ownership of it in order to facilitate international participation in its management moving forward. So the news here is that in 10 days, on September 30th, the NTIA, which has been the contractor under the ICANN to perform the IANA services, intends to allow its contract with ICANN to expire, at which time ICANN will assume stewardship of the IANA's key technical functions. And this is only controversial in some corners, arguably with people who don't really understand what's going on. Most internet experts and the major internet companies, you know, Apple and Google and their ilk, universally support this internet governance transition, because it counters the growing argument which repressive regimes can use to lobby for greater power over internet governance or even their own local internet by breaking off from the global internet altogether. In other words, if it can be said that the internet is a U.S. controlled thing, then Putin over in Russia can say, we're not sharing this network with the United States that is controlling the whole thing. We're going to just sever ties and use and create our own Russian network that is disconnected from the global one.
That is important, but that is really a PR thing, though, because, I mean, oppressive governments are going to want to break off from the internet anyway. So they're going to want their own version.
They're going to want control.
Right. So, but this makes it so that they can't publicly say, well, we're only doing this because the horrible, horrible empire that is the United States controls the internet right now. We can't stand for that. This way, we can say, no, it's under private control. So it's a private corporation, a multinational. Everybody has a stake in it. We are out. Now, okay, we are getting a little bit of a letter salad going on in the chat room. So we know what ICANN is. We know what the IANA is. Where does ARIN fit in? So that's the American Registry for Internet Numbers. Where do they fit in the grand scheme of assigning IP addresses?
You know, in terms of the bureaucracy, I don't know who they report to. It feels like they would be another ICANN. Technically, ICANN is the overlord. ICANN is the entity that has responsibility, which is why it was subcontracting the work that the IANA needed to do to the NTIA, which now is coming back to it. But again, you'd have to look at it like an org chart of bureaucracy of the internet, which, as I said, I have shied away from as much as possible. But you're right. ARIN is another one of these bureaucratic but necessary registries to maintain order.
Right. And we've actually had them on This Week in Enterprise Tech, I think three or four times. Their president, John Kern, was talking about their most recent push for IPv6 and DNSSEC. So that's a good thing. I like that about the organization. But I want to talk about a little bit about the transition we made between the last story and this story when we were talking about the mistrust of government institution. And therefore, that's why we're getting rid of the IANA. But it should be noted that ICANN does have a bit of a checkered past. They had a at-large board member by the name of Carl Auerbach, who was a longtime member of the Interop team and a frequent guest to This Week in Enterprise Tech, who he wanted financial transparency for ICANN. He wanted them to publish a budget just like every other public organization on the planet, and they fought him tooth and nail. Steve, I want to throw back to you. We in the United States tend not to trust the government and we trust corporations, even though it could be argued that ICANN is less transparent about what it does and how it uses the resources at hand than the U.S. government.
Yeah, I have to plead ignorance in, about the individual specifics. I know that Esther Dyson was intimately involved with ICANN. She was a board member for some period of time. Her integrity is beyond question, but she also wasn't running the whole thing. And I've been a board member of various organizations where I've ended up resigning ultimately because I was frustrated with the way the whole entity operated and politics.
Yeah, that's a very, very common experience. I know a lot of people who have had some sort of involvement and just kind of threw their hands up and walked away and said, I don't know how to navigate this organization. Yeah. I guess it works. I have no idea how that is.
Like, where does the work actually get done? Who does anything here? Because all we're seeing is reports.
Yep.
And, you know, memos flying back and forth. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned DNSSEC, and I am so bullish on, as the listeners of this podcast know, on the promise of DNSSEC. That is, if we, or when we, because we're clearly moving in that direction, when we have a securely verifiable internet scale directory, what we can do is it's hard to think of anything you can't do. For example, the existing troubled certificate authority structure, which we bemoan just because it has become so bloated and because we're now trusting many, many hundreds of certificate authorities who say they're going to act on our behalf and correctly, but we keep finding instances, discovering instances where they have failed in that mission. And so, for example, there is no reason that a server's certificate has to work the way it does, where we trust a certificate authority to sign our public key to assert its validity on our behalf. After all, you know, we created the key pair. We have the private key. We give them the public key. Ask, or in some cases pay, but now with Let's Encrypt, it's an automated process, get a signature which asserts, if nothing more, that we're who we say we are, or that we do control the domain that this certificate is providing security for. So if we had DNSSEC, there's already a protocol. I think it's DAME. Or D-A-N-E, I don't remember. I think it's Dane, D-A-N-E, which is a DNSSEC-based certificate solution. That is, you ask DNS for the private key of your site rather than needing to accept its signature from a certificate authority. So, and that's just one example. I mean, just the mind boggles when we could have a scalable controlled caching, truly secure global directory that can contain all manner of different information. So I'm, you know, it's taking a while to get there. Comcast got their route signed in 2012. Google's DNS has had their sign since 2013. I've looked at it for GRC out of curiosity, but it's like, well, okay, well, there's nothing I really at this point that I want to secure from GRC's DNS. And at the moment, the tools are awkward to use. I think Hover, which is the name server that I'm using, or the registrar, I think they can provide DNSSEC. But I'm also playing with my DNS records often. In fact, later in the story, in today's podcast, I'll explain how I had to do that as part of this cross-site scripting issue. And that would have broken the signing of my domain, and it would have been a problem because I would have had to then, you know, get it re-signed. So, you know, we're still in this awkward stage. But the point of all this is that there is an intriguing event that is on the horizon, and that is that the famous DNSSEC root zone signing key, as it's called, is being changed for the first time. There are no known problems. It's just regarded as good security policy to rotate your keys periodically, especially for something as high value as the DNSSEC root zone signing key. And in the process, they are doubling its size. So they're also, as we always do, moving to larger size keys as the ability to crack smaller keys, you know, gets worrisomely close. No one thinks that though the 1024-bit key today is vulnerable. So now is a good time. As has been said in some of the coverage of this, there's no emergency. It's a quiet time. That's when you want to do this, is because it's a big change. So they're going to go from a 1024-bit key to a 2048-bit key. And, you know, the process is almost mystical. I mean, it's weird how you can imagine the value of this key. If the private side of the key pair were to escape absolute control, it would allow any entity, a nation state or anyone, to essentially spoof DNS with no ability to detect it, because it would have been signed properly. It would be signed by a private key that everyone holding the matching public key would authenticate.
Which, Steve, I think means if the secret key were to escape, it would essentially become the DNS that we're all using right now.
Well, that's a very good point. There's no encryption by default on DNS. It's a UDP packet. Everybody can see it go out. Everybody can see it come back. And your computer implicitly trusts it. It's just, okay, this is the IP for the domain I'm going to. And notice that, you know, when we're talking about security vulnerabilities of, for example, like how do we know if a TLS certificate is valid, it's does it match the domain name? You know, and when we see the name in the browser, it's like, oh, okay. But there's an implicit assumption that the IP address behind that domain name in the browser's URL is the correct IP, because, and the point is that crucial in the exploitation of this is spoofing DNS. And we don't talk about it as much as we should, but it is an Achilles heel. It's in fact, as we secure other bits, this is the one which sort of is beginning to stick out as, boy, you know, we got to get, let's get moving on locking down DNS, because we've been running around doing all the easy bits and we're kind of running out of those because everything's getting pretty secure. But DNS, it also, we have to trust that domain name to IP address mapping.
And it's not just that it's insecure, it's that it's scary insecure. We were explaining this to a group of people who dropped by Interop Labs a few years back, and the easiest way to explain it was, currently DNS is a yelling contest. If you can yell louder than the other machines around you that you are the domain that you want to spoof, it belongs to you. That's how it works, which is why we were making a big push for DNSSEC and DNS Dane. And actually, we did talk with Cricket Lou from Infoblox about DNS Dane, and he was saying it's not just that it's a more secure system. It's that it makes it easier for people to actually start using certificates without using CAs that can be compromised, that can get revoked, that just might be bad actors. As you've talked about on Security Now, we've already run into at least two that they weren't even pretending to be issuing valid certificates, and yet they were still in the trusted CA list. So, and actually, the real part I wanted to bring out about this, and this is what I find so beautiful about this story, is when DNSSEC was first cooked up, they built in this function, this ability to upgrade the key into the spec, which is huge. That's important. It means that it's a forward-looking standard. They realize that we are at some point going to need to upgrade the encryption level from 1028 to 2048, maybe to 4096, and we don't want to break it by upgrading security. So this is the first real test of us saying, okay, well, upgrade it and let's see what happens to those who are currently using DNSSEC.
So I love this description of the procedure. ICANN incorporates some extraordinary security measures and considers its potential threats as everything up to nation states. At its quarterly ceremonies, so-called crypto officers from all over the world congregate in one of the key management facilities after passing multiple layers of physical and digital security. Next month, this coming October, in a hyper-secure key management facility on the U.S. East Coast, ICANN will generate a new cryptographic key pair. One half of that pair is private and will be kept super securely by ICANN. The other is public. Internet service providers, hardware manufacturers, Linux and other OS developers, anything and anyone who needs to verify future DNSSEC records needs to have the updated DNSSEC public key. Then, in the first quarter of next year, 2017, two employees will transport a copy of the encrypted key files on a smart card over to another facility on the West Coast using regular commercial transport. I thought it was interesting that they tossed that in, I guess, what, instead of a military jet or something. Eventually, the public part, or I guess a private executive jet or something, anyway, yeah, standard commercial transport in full public view, but super encrypted. Eventually, the public part of the key pair will then be distributed to other organizations. And then finally, the whole switchover will take around 2 years from start to finish. The new key will appear in the DNS for the first time on July 11th, 2017. So next summer, next July 11th, and then in October of 2017, the new key will be used for making signatures. So I imagine that initially it'll be cross-signed, so you'll be able to continue using your previous 1024-bit key, yet the root will also be signed with the new 24-bit key, and then any new equipment, And of course, OSs will be updated, and anything using and depending upon DNSSEC will need to, there'll be some grace period, which is probably where this 2 years comes in, where both keys, both the old and the new, either can be used. And then eventually it will be necessary to retire the 1024-bit key after, and I'm sure they'll be able to, you know, get statistics and things and watch to see the hopefully quickly diminishing use of the 1024-bit key. But if history is any lesson, there'll have to be a threat of, okay, this key is being removed on this date. Everybody, you've had 2 years, get your act together, update to the public key. And, you know, in embedded appliances and devices, that can be a challenge.
You know, Steve, I think they're missing out on a great opportunity here. And if anyone at ICANN is listening, you could take advantage of my Priestly experience, because I think this meeting should have seven figures that are robed in, you know, brown robes so you can't see their faces. And there's a big smart card in the middle of the room shrouded in fog, and it lights up as the key is copied to it, and it's broken into seven pieces and sent to various parts of the world.
See, I think it's very much like that, Robert.
It's all about the mystic experience.
I've seen some of the videos of these ceremonies. No, there's a lot. They're very serious.
I've seen it, and it is like that, except they don't have the robes and the fog and the weird light and the Celtic music in the background. See, they're missing an opportunity, Steve.
I might freak some people out. I'm not sure.
This is how the internet works.
Yeah. So we've been following Google's efforts for years to strengthen the security of the internet. And you know, the most controversial one, I would argue, was their decision to move up the already planned sunsetting of SHA-1 hashed and signed certificates. But that happened, and starting as of at the beginning of this year, no CA is issuing an SHA-1 hash signed certificate, so okay, that's behind us. Now Google is turning their attention to the problem that while HTTPS connections are shown as explicitly secure, non-HTTPS connections are just kind of vanilla. That is, they don't say anything. And Google's concern is that in the long term, once we accept the idea that HTTPS, protected with TLS privacy and authentication, is the de facto web protocol, not HTTP. Remember, traditionally, HTTP was the de facto protocol. And even as recently as a few years ago, major sites would switch their users to HTTPS only while transacting privileged information. And controversially, they would leave their cookies, which were maintaining session, when the browser switched back to HTTP, allowing things like the Fire Sheep attack, which made it trivial to impersonate people in any open Wi-Fi environment. So Google is saying, okay, our next push is we're going to actively discriminate against non-HTTPS connections. So in their blog post, they wrote, to help users... Oh, then, by the way, this is starting January 2017. So the beginning of next year, only a few months away, to help users browse the web safely, Chrome indicates connection security with an icon in the address bar. Historically, Chrome has not explicitly labeled HTTP connections as non-secure. Beginning in January 2015 with Chrome 58, will mark HTTP pages that collect passwords or credit cards as non-secure. as part of a long-term plan to mark all HTTP sites as non-secure. Chrome currently indicates, they write, HTTP connections with a neutral indicator. This doesn't reflect the true lack of security for HTTP connections. In other words, you can sort of see the thinking now. It's like, it's not that this connection is secure, oh goody. It's, wait a minute, why is this one not secure? That's bad. So they say, when you load a website over HTTP, someone else on the network can look at or modify the site before it gets to you. A substantial portion of web traffic has transitioned to HTTPS so far, and HTTPS usage is consistently increasing. We recently hit a milestone with more than half of Chrome desktop page loads now served over HTTPS. In addition, since the time we released our HTTPS report in February, 12 more of the top 100 websites have changed their serving default from HTTP to HTTPS. Studies show that users do not perceive the lack of a secure icon as a warning, but also that users become blind to warnings that occur too frequently. Our plan to label HTTP sites more clearly and accurately as non-secure will take place in gradual steps based on increasingly stringent criteria. Starting January 2017, Chrome 56 will label HTTP pages with password or credit card form fields as not secure, given their particularly sensitive nature. In following releases, we will continue to extend HTTP warnings, for example, by labeling HTTP pages as not secure initially in an incognito mode, where users may have higher expectations of privacy. Eventually, we plan to label all HTTP pages as non-secure and change the HTTP security indicator to the red triangle that we use for broken HTTPS. So, anytime someone uses their power, as Google is, it creates some controversy. And, you know, no one likes being told what to do. I imagine there will be people who, for some reason, HTTPS is a problem, is not practical, is that like something prevents them from doing it. I don't know what, but something. So the dicey part here is that Chrome is going to be scaring anybody who uses those servers. Now, we could argue, well, they deserve to be scared, or this needs to put pressure on that problem to get it fixed, which may be the case. Ultimately, everyone knows I'm bullish. GRC has been HSTS, strict transport secure, for years, and known by all the browsers that way. And ultimately, I think this is clearly where we need to go. But, you know, Chrome is now has the lion's share of the browser market, and is taking advantage of that in order to push security forward, which ultimately, I mean, I think the process is always painful, like what we went through with SHA-1 certs. But once you're past it, it's like, okay, this is better now. And every lesson that we have been taught by this industry is, I mean, okay, just say IPv4, is we're not moving unless we're not doing it, unless something makes us.
You know, Steve, we've got a couple of folks in the chat room. We've got Klaatu and Eric Duckman who are saying things like, well, you know, some sites don't need HTTPS. And you've got Eric Duckman saying, oh, what, so everyone's supposed to get a cert now? And I understand that frustration, but at the same time, no. Absolutely not. The argument that only some things need to be encrypted is the wrong way to think about it. I think both of us are in agreement that you encrypt everything because you don't want people to know what's important by what's encrypted and what's not. It should be equally for them to break into my WordPress session where I'm reading a blog as it is for them to break into my session that's transferring financial information. And as far as
we have a perfect, just interrupt you for one second, a perfect example of that is what law enforcement has called the going dark problem. Well, how do they know it's going dark if they weren't looking for the light?
Precisely. And as far as certificates are concerned, I mean, this is the DNS Dane story. We are about to get a system based off of DNSSEC using the same key from DNSSEC that will allow us to have certificates at a much lower price, read free, that are more secure and more easy to revoke when they go bad. So I like that Google's doing this. They're one of the only entities that has the muscle to shame sites into doing what they should have done a long time ago. I mean, the internet should be end-to-end encrypted.
Yes. It is a enduring problem that security is an afterthought for the internet. I mean, we need to cut them a lot of slack because they were amazed when a packet made it between two of their IMP processors in the, you know, on day one. Back when it was the ARPANET, and it's like, oh my God, you mean this actually works? And so no one could have foreseen what was going to happen. You know, I mean, I'm still complaining about the fact that we have to say http://. You know, who was this designed for? This wasn't designed for people. So yeah, we're dragging a lot of legacy behind. But I completely agree with you. I think that, and don't forget too, Let's Encrypt does automate and make easy and has been a huge success with exponential growth in the number of certificates that they're issuing, providing trusted certificates at no cost. And from what I've seen in people who are complaining, I get it. There are technical reasons, you know, it's like, they're on a shared hosting provider and cPanel doesn't yet support Let's Encrypt. Well, okay, it needs to fix that. And then those sites can use encryption and everybody will be happy. And so, yeah, again, there's going to be some pain, but I think where Google is taking us is the right direction.
Yeah. And I'm okay with some short-term pain for some very long-term gains. What we are talking about is a long-term game. I think we can all agree that everything encrypted is a better way to do business and to live on the internet. And yeah, it seems a little heavy-handed. I get it. I get it, folks. Some people don't like the fact that Google is using its huge market share to be able to force this change. But someone has to force the change because otherwise it won't happen.
Yeah. On this podcast, we're constantly talking about the reticence to change, the inertia against change. It's significant.
Right.
So
Steve, before we get to the next story, because the next story is actually quite interesting, we need to do two things. First, I need to tell Loquacious One in the chat room that we love him because he's not feeling the love. And the second thing is
we love you, whoever you are.
There you go. We need to take another break to thank another sponsor of Security Now. Hey, folks, let me ask you something. Have you ever tried to get a mortgage? I mean, it's not the most comfortable process in the world. You end up having to go into a bank. You bring up all your financial transaction records, trying to convince someone that you are a good investment, that you're a good bet. That's not fun. I mean, even in the best of times, it's demeaning. It takes a long time. And you're always sweating about whether or not those weeks and weeks, maybe months of preparation are going to lead to you getting the loan that you need. Well, if you're doing it that way, you're doing it the wrong way. Because we live in the modern world. And in the modern world, we can do everything online, especially if we use Rocket Mortgage by Quick. Now, Rocket Mortgage is the new way to get a mortgage. They bring the mortgage approval process into the 21st century. It's fast, It's powerful. It's completely online. They've taken all of the complicated, time-consuming parts of applying for a mortgage out of the equation. Do you hate searching through those stacks of old files and paperwork? Do you hate bringing that in a big box into the bank in order to lay it out on a desk and show people that you've been responsible with your finances? Well, with Rocket Mortgage, you don't have to do that. You can easily share your bank statements and pay stubs at the touch of a button. It helps you get your approval in minutes for a custom mortgage solution that's been tailored for your unique financial situation. No more cookie cutter templates of your interest rates and how much you have to put in and how much you get out. Rocket Mortgage understands that you are you, and that's how they treat you. Now, even better, with Rocket Mortgage, you can do all of this on your phone or your tablet, so you can apply for your mortgage no matter where you are, no matter how you're accessing the internet. It's a quick online process that you can manage from the convenience of your couch. Now, folks, if you are applying for a mortgage the old way, you're just working too hard. If you're looking to refinance your mortgage or buy a home, check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/securitynow. That's quickenloans.com/securitynow. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSConsumerAccess.org 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of Security Now. All right, Steve, here's a story that I know some people are tired of hearing about, but it's important. And it's important because it deals with the devices that we use each and every day and sometimes assume that they are secure, even though we know that they're not. Tell me a little bit more about the iPhone 5C NAND saga.
So what was interesting about this, I've got the links to the detailed PDF in the show notes, and there's no need to dig in. But for anyone who's interested in step-by-step, how was this done, this research is just fabulous. Lots of photos showing what this engineer went through in order to pull this off. And we've covered the concept of this when it was brought up. And that was, you have a phone which is locked, and the person will not or cannot divulge the information. Maybe they know they're no longer alive, but the government or law enforcement is desperate to get into the phone. So the problem is that as a security measure, proper security, Apple has a lockout after X number of wrong guesses at the security code. But And so there have been hacks in the past that we've discussed where guessing the code, seeing that it's wrong, and then immediately powering down the phone before it has the chance to update the non-volatile counter in memory, it was an example. And that worked for a while. You would guess it, see that it didn't work, quickly power down the phone, and that guess wouldn't count against your X number of strikes. However, Apple fixed that so that no longer worked. And the 5C has that advanced technology where you can no longer perform this fast power shutdown reboot in order to prevent the fact of the guess failing from being written to non-volatile memory. So any engineer looking at this says, oh, well, then what we need to do is clone that memory before we even start guessing. Make a copy of it. And then we'll make as many guesses as we can before the phone gets upset, and then copy from the clone back to the working memory, which essentially resets the count as if we had never made any guesses. But we obviously don't repeat those guesses. We make new guesses until we decide it's no longer safe, and we repeat the process. So the theoretical concept of cloning the iPhone's memory, and that is with a state where guesses were allowed, and then resetting the state. It's an end around all of the other security measures, but it was only until now theoretical. We've talked about it on this podcast. It's been proposed. No one had done it. It has now been done. So the abstract of this paper, I'll just read this from the top, says, this paper is a short summary, but it's actually not. It's a wonderfully detailed summary of a real-world mirroring attack on the Apple iPhone 5C passcode retry counter under iOS 9. This was achieved by desoldering the NAND flash chip of a sample phone in order to physically access its connection to the SoC, the system on a chip, and partially reverse engineering its proprietary bus protocol. The process does not require any expensive and sophisticated equipment, although having looked at the pictures, it's not for the faint of heart either. You need a steady hand. All needed parts are low cost and were obtained from local electronics distributors. By using the described and successful hardware mirroring process, it was possible to bypass the limit on passcode retry attempts. This is the first public demonstration of the working prototype and the real hardware mirroring process for iPhone 5C. Although the process can be improved, it is still a successful proof of concept project. Knowledge of the possibility of mirroring will definitely help in designing systems with better protection. And in fact, I will propose some of that before we're done. Also, they write, some reliability issues related to the NAND memory allocation in iPhone 5C are revealed. Some future research directions are outlined in this paper, and several possible countermeasures are suggested. We show that claims that iPhone 5C NAND mirroring was infeasible were ill-advised. Now, I went through the paper, and I am really impressed with this guy. And so I just want to share a little bit of some of the inner techiness that demonstrates that Apple was aware of this and proactively worked to thwart it in a sneaky way. They're going to have to up their game with the next round of hardware. I don't know what the 6 or the 7 phones look like. But so in one part of the paper where they get into actually making this happen, they say the process of cloning involves creating a fully working copy of the NAND flash memory chip. However, it was already mentioned in the previous section, simply copying the 8 gig information from the original chip into another identical chip taken from another iPhone 5C does not give the desired result and the iPhone does not boot, meaning cloning was not enough. Some additional research was undertaken to figure out why simple copying doesn't work. For that same model of the NAND flash chip was programmed with the data from the original chip, and then the communication was, there should have been a comma there. The same model of the NAND flash chip was programmed with the data from the original chip, and then the communication was analyzed with both an oscilloscope and a logic analyzer. First, some pages were accessed from addresses outside the normal 16 gigabyte address space. For example, instead of reading and writing to the block, and they give an example, 00041AXX, the CPU was accessing the block 00841AXX. Although such addresses wrap around and are mapped back into 00041AXX block, the page numbers were different, as well as the status of those pages. Then they have a figure that shows a table of a bunch of those just to detail it. Secondly, some irregularities were found in the communication prior to the access of those hidden pages. Although the data transfer during the access is performed in the SDR mode at 17 megahertz, while the configuration commands use even slower speed of 1 megahertz, some data inside the commands are smuggled at an astonishing rate of 256 megabytes per second in DDR3 mode. Also, a dummy value for data bit 7 was introduced for the period of 23 nanoseconds. Given that the data setup time in those transfers is less than 1 nanosecond, there is a very high chance that such information would be overlooked by most would-be attackers. So, decoding that, this means that Apple deliberately, they understood that there was a vulnerability when the NAND chip that stored the keys to the kingdom in many ways was physically separate from the SoC, from the processor, the system on a chip. That is, there were communication lines connecting them that exposed a bus which the processor used to communicate with the memory, which was then subject to reverse engineering. So knowing that, they went to tremendous effort essentially to hide critical details of what was going on, like in otherwise much shorter and faster little bursts of data that you wouldn't see unless you really, really looked closely enough, down to a resolution of 1/1,000,000th of a second. So they continue, after those findings, the implementation of the communication protocol was amended in the test board, because they've through this process built a number of different jigs in order to hold these bits with this poor looking red case iPhone 5C with its back cut open and wires coming out of it like a zombie. Then the data mirroring software was modified to include cloning the hidden pages. As a result, the newly created clone of the original NAND chip was fully functional in the iPhone 5C. It was then tested with 6 incorrect passcode attempts before replacing it with the original chip. After the boot process, it was possible to enter the incorrect passcodes again 6 times until the 1-minute delay was introduced. This fully proved the correctness of the hardware NAND mirroring attack on iPhone 5C. And then to put this in real-world terms, they write, because there's no limitation on the number of such NAND clones, they can be created in advance and restored in parallel when one of them is being used for passcode testing. And I would argue that you could also do deeper reverse engineering in order just to zap whatever is little bits are being changed and put those back by, you know, comparing pre and post. This way, it only requires 45 seconds for 6 passcode attempts. For 4-digit passcode, the maximum attack time would be, and then they do the math, 75,000 seconds or about 20 hours. For 6-digit passcodes, this time will increase to about 3 months, which, in some cases, might be acceptable. So I just that was too much detail yeah. not to share. It's just, you know, wonderful stuff.
Let me ask you, because the trick that they did with accessing address spaces outside of the standard 16 megabyte block, was that randomized? So I know in order to access block A, you actually had to access block X, which referred back to block A.
Right.
Does that change, or would that be the same on every iPhone? Is it like address space randomization that you would get in a Windows box?
From something else they said elsewhere, and I didn't have it in my notes, they indicated that it was swapped out pages.
Okay.
So I think that that's fatigue. You know, it's wear leveling of the NAND. So for whatever reason, they needed to clone that as well. That is like they had to develop an awareness of the physical location, not just the a logically addressable location, and incorporate that. And again, that may have been by design. That feels like it was another confounding factor
right.
that Apple added, just thinking, this will get them.
Well, I mean, it's just that one little extra bit where, well, if they figure out where the actual, what the address spaces are, this will throw them off because they actually have to access a different address space in order to access the address space that they want. But,
right.
But I mean, it sounds like then it's not random. It's just a reassignment.
Yes.
Hmm.
Yeah. And they mapped that out and then showed us a table of where the reassignments were. And once they incorporated that into their clone, then the 5C didn't know there was any difference. It thought it was talking to the original chip.
Steve, Creamy Corn
talking to a true copy.
Creamy Corncob in the chat room has an interesting question. He wants to know what is the actual encryption that takes place between the SoC and the NAND itself? Because the NAND, it's not specialized NAND. They've got it from Hynix, and then they're running their own encryption on top of it. So is there encryption between the SoC and the NAND?
I don't know that. To me, from the description, it does not sound like a standard part. They were playing some games at the electrical protocol level, which would violate the specifications of a standard NAND chip. So my guess is that Apple had these things custom made. They had a little, they tweaked the NAND controller in a way that customized it for their use. And the trick of this is that by cloning the memory, it was not necessary to decrypt the protocol.
Right.
So, for example, both ends could have a private key, and all you would see is gibberish going across the bus because you would never see it in plain text. But if you are able to without knowing anything about what it means, if you just copy it and use its behavior rather than its information, then you get a shortcut.
Well, I mean, that in itself is fascinating, that iPhone NAND is not regular NAND. It's not what every other manufacturer is buying.
If I read what they wrote, the fact that they were sending a little burst of data, essentially hiding a small packet of information, well, that's not no spec reads like that. That's special.
That's very special. And you know what? There are some people in the chat room who are joking that this is way too propeller head. And yeah, you know what? It's getting over my propeller head too, because anytime someone talks about how they hooked up an oscilloscope and they were able to figure out what it was doing just by looking at the waveforms, I'm nowhere near that. But that's a lot of skill. That's a lot of knowledge. Are you going to bust out your oscilloscope?
Well, no, I mean, it's... it's...
right here.
I can build an oscilloscope, but I don't know how to use it. I mean, because all they're looking at is they're looking at the rising and the falling edges of the clock, right? They're looking at, well, what are they receiving back when they send a signal to the individual cells?
Correct. Although these things all have a lot of lines. One of the things that has happened is we've gone to a much more serial world than we used to have. Look at the slots on our motherboards. You know, they're little itty bitty slots, yet it's like faster than when we had huge long slots. So the idea is we're going to serialize things in order to bring pin counts down, to minimize bus size, and also You need driver electronics at each end in order to make this all happen faster. It's much better if you have only a couple of them than if you have like 64 of them. You know, move the 64 bits down one lane rather than all in parallel across 64. It's a huge savings in chip size, in pin count, in bus complexity. Anyway, I understand that this is techie, but I thought it was fun to basically rip the cover off, so to speak, of an actual exploit, a physical exploit against the phone, which works.
Yes.
And if anyone wants to see the link is in the show notes. The pictures are just captivating. The guys really documented it beautifully.
That's a lot of work. I understand. Yeah, everything that's there, I can build, or I probably have in my lab already, but to say that this is something that you can do easily, no.
Well, and there's no instruction manual. Yeah. You know, this is all, first of all, I don't even know how you unsolder a BGA, a ball grid array NAND, because, I mean, it's got little solder dots on the bottom of it.
Right.
It's like, and so it's done once and it's there for good. So I don't know even know how this guy got it off of the back plane.
Well, I have the device to make that happen, but it would destroy the PCB. So
right.
Again, don't try this at home, folks. Leave it to the professionals and the professional amateurs.
So I had three bits of miscellany. I got a tweet from a Will D who said, at SGGRC, my school's DNS server was down this morning, but I remembered your DNS benchmark tool. I am back online and faster than before. Thanks. So I did just want to remind people that Windows app that runs under Wine. So if you've got Wine emulation in Linux, you can use it there too, or even on your Mac. It's become the industry standard DNS benchmark. Google had something for a while, but it sort of fell by the wayside. And this little bit of freeware that I wrote, I think it was like in 06, really does the job. And so I just wanted to put it back on people's radar. Remember, we spent a lot of time talking about DNS in various contexts today. You have to, our browsers have to have the IP address, the physical internet protocol address of all the sites that they're accessing data from. And today's web pages are covered with resources coming from just a huge scattering of servers. If your local machine doesn't already know what the IPs are, it's got to ask somebody and it's got to wait until it gets an answer. So if you're not using fast DNS, your entire experience of the internet is hampered by that, because it's the first thing that happens is that those ASCII names get mapped into an IP address.
Right. Yeah, I actually a fan of the network sent me a little plugin that he's creating for Synology's router, their RT1900 AC. It's their SRM operating system. It allows for plugins just like you would have on one of their NASs. And what he created was a service that you could put an app on your desktop, and every time you do any sort of search, it breaks down how much time it took for the query to take place versus how much time it took for the actual content you requested to be downloaded. And it's fascinating to have that running up on the desktop, and you get to see, wow, I spent more time waiting for DNS than it took to download all this text and pictures.
Yeah,
and it does kind of change your appreciation for good DNS.
Well, and you know that DNS sometimes doesn't get the attention from ISPs that it deserves. It's not sexy. It's sort of, okay, we have to provide a DNS server. Maybe they don't give it the fastest one because they want their website to run fast, but DNS, you know, and no one really complains when it's slow. So your ISP, you know, it's sort of like the unloved stepchild of internet service providers. It's like, yeah, well, yeah, we have it. And so it's worth making sure that you're not being slowed down because your ISP doesn't care to give you good DNS. You can certainly change it, you know, take responsibility and find something faster. And GRC's little DNS benchmark tells you, you know, helps you rate all of your alternatives.
Steve, you run your own DNS, right?
Yeah.
You do. I used to, and then I two moves ago, I decided I just didn't want to bring the box with me anymore. And so I've used Google 8888 and OpenDNS at, what is it, 208.67.222.222 and 220.220.
That's right.
What are, if you had to use a third party, what would be your favorites?
I'm with you. I still like 4.2.2.1.
Yes, of course.
And of course, that's a level 3 server, and I'm hosted by level 3, so that works. And 8888 is another choice. What I do is one of my FreeBSD boxes, the one that runs the GRC news groups, the NNTP groups, that also runs Bind, and mine is a master for two level 3 slaves. So when they need to check in and get an updated zone, they ask for that from me. And so the public sees these very strong big iron DNS servers that can handle any load that are super well connected. They're right on the internet backbone for high performance. And then when I make changes, I'm able to send them an update command that causes them to immediately refetch an updated zone file. So it's sort of the best of both worlds. I don't actually myself handle any public traffic. They're my front servers for me, but mine has the master records that they pull from as needed.
All right, let's move to a different type of DNS question. People always ask what I use to host my services, and I'm lucky enough to actually still have access. I have a slash 8 that I can borrow from every once in a while, an IPv4 space, which is amazing.
Ooh.
Yeah, I know. So I don't. I still like using my quads, but some people want to use a third party solution.
Well, we talked last week about the whole dynamic DNS issue. We were talking about the idea that it was a Q&A episode, and one of the people asked, you know, do you still recommend ProXPN as a VPN provider? And I explained that there were certainly applications where using any of the major hosting, you know, VPN hosts made sense. And you wanted one that was not going to be logging and tracking your traffic for prudence. And we know that ProXPN doesn't. So it's as good as any others. But the position I took was that the problem with that is that very much like a Tor exit node, a VPN server will be emitting traffic onto the net from all the people using the service. And that just has to be a tasty spot for any government agencies that are interested in what it is that people are doing over their VPNs. Why do they need more privacy, for example, or need to appear to be in a different location than they actually are? So the nature of its concentration of traffic is a little off-putting in today's world. So what we're seeing now are good options for running an open VPN server on your own router at home. We've talked about that. There's a project called PyVPN, which takes a Raspberry Pi and using a shell script just completely automates the process of establishing and configuring an open VPN server for $35 in a little Raspberry Pi, which you then plug into a port on a generic router. Do a little bit of port mapping so you can get to it from the outside, and now you've got an open VPN endpoint. And then the alternative is if you have something like pfSense running on a router, or the router that's now the show favorite is the Ubiquiti Edge router, all of those are FreeBSD-based and have open VPN servers built into them. So the problem, of course, though, is that ISPs are not obligated to give their typical home cable or DSL subscribers a static IP. That requires dynamic DNS. That means we need a some service in a fixed location on the public internet that we can refer to who has been updated by our device about its current IP. And so I talked about last week that Google's domain name services for $1 a month, $12 a year, would provide domain name and provide dynamic DNS as part of the bundle. There's another registrar, Namecheap, that also offers dynamic DNS. Hover, my chosen registrar, does not. But Kevin Garman tweeted me about a service that I wasn't aware of, and I've not used it, but I spent some time poking around, and I'm impressed. It just has the right feel to it. It's called, unfortunately, afraid.org, AFRAID.org. It's free BSD based. His slogan near the top of the page says, "Why is it free?" It's quite simple. We wanted a challenge. That's it. So what this lets you do is they're a DNS server and essentially a DNS host. So you can create your name .afraid.com. That is whatever you want .afraid.com, and point it at your home IP, and then use the dynamic DNS support in your router to keep it updated if your home IP changes. And they offer a bunch of other services. So I just wanted to sort of put it on our listeners' radar, afraid.org for free DNS, including dynamic DNS. And I just, as I was poking around there, I just got a good feeling about the place. It looks like, you know, the right kind of deal.
Yeah, I still have a bad experience that I remember every time someone asked me about dynamic DNS. I was living with a Jesuit who he wanted to host his own little web server. So I showed him how to make a web server. And then he said he was going to use dynamic DNS. I'm like, okay, so obviously he knows what he's doing. But he didn't. And all he did was he opened up a DMZ port, all the ports to the box. And so within 24 hours, I started seeing this weird traffic running over our network. And I go over, I'm like, yeah, you that was one of the fastest ownings I've ever seen. Congratulations. So yeah, if you're going to do this, just make sure you understand port forwarding and know what services you actually want to run. And then what I would suggest is you run shields up against your newly created dynamic address just to make sure it's only listening on the ports you want.
Yep.
Yeah.
Exactly.
All right. That's good to know. Afraid.org.
Yes, afraid.org. Check it out if it sounds like it might be interesting to people. It looks like a straight up good deal. I feel good about it looking at it. Simon Zarafa, who's a friend of the show and frequently sends me valuable links and tips and oftentimes funny O'Reilly covers. He sent me something he wanted me to share. He said, "Hi, Steve, can I please request a PSA?" Which I thought, PSA, okay, that's don't know. I figured that
public service announcement.
Public service announcement, okay. For this week's show, I thought maybe a personal shout out or something. I didn't know what. Anyway, public service announcement. Thank you. For this week's show, he says, "My wife had a serious medical emergency yesterday, and we hadn't filled in the emergency contact information on the iOS health app. As a result, the emergency services were delayed in contacting me. Can we ask listeners with iOS devices to fill that info in and enable it on their lock screens? It should make it easier in the future for emergency services to contact people and won't require them to enter their iOS PIN code to access their emergency contact details." So I thought that was a great tip. It hadn't occurred to me. It's the kind of thing you never think to do, but once you wish you had, it's often too late. So now would be a good time to do that. It makes a lot of sense to, apparently Something happened to his wife such that she was unable to provide her contact information. They had her phone, but they couldn't get into it in order to know who to contact. So thank you, Simon. That's a great tip.
I just realized that your smart device is your new medical ID bracelet, the little thing that you used to carry. I mean, I used to carry one that would say what you're allergic to and who I should contact.
Right.
I haven't done that in over two decades because now I just carry my mobile device and it does have my emergency contact info on the front locks page.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
You know what, Steve? I can't do an episode of Security Now unless I hear about SpinRite.
Well, believe me, you're not subjected to them every single week like all of our listeners. I just have two short notes, one there that are kind of fun. Michael Nation in Michigan, he referred to me as Steve Areno, and he said apologies to Steve Allen. He said, I run SpinRite on all my drives all the time, and nothing ever goes wrong. I'm disappointed. If I'm paying for health insurance, I expect, well, to get sick. And so I thought, okay. And then I thought, okay, wait. The health insurance analogy, the right analogy would be more like you, or the to apply the health insurance analogy would be more like using RAID to recover from drive problems. Using SpinRite is more like taking an adequate level of vitamin D to prevent any drive from having problems in the first place. So, you know, insurance doesn't keep you well. SpinRite does keep your drives well. So I think that's, you know, even better than having something that is able to recover from problems or, you know, cover you if there are problems. Just not don't have them in the first place. And then an anonymous person shot me a note with the subject, SpinRite rescues a stuck Windows 10 update. And that's the first I'd heard of that happening. He said, my Windows 10 version 1607 patches got stuck today. And this isn't the first time in all. Although it is the first time for a version 1607 update, retrying didn't and doesn't help. So usually I would revert using System Restore and try re-updating again. But this time I tried SpinRite and it worked. So this is sort of a reminder that drives are, they continue to be, even SSDs we are finding, arguably the least reliable component in the system. Everything else is just, it's a lot more solid. Maybe we're demanding much less of it. Certainly, the bit density of mass storage has been subjected to huge competitive pressure for decades now, with the consequence being, you know, we all see reports about drives not lasting as long as they used to, manufacturers creeping the warranties down over time, just sort of hoping no one will notice that they went from a 5-year to a 3-year warranty. And so forth, because, you know, they're under pressure. I'm happy that these the mechanical spinning drives are staying alive, although, you know, it looks like SpinRite is going to be able to provide a solution for non-spinning mass storage as well, based on experience. But for what it's worth, when something doesn't seem right, just run SpinRite on the system. And a surprising number of times, it actually was a small mass storage glitch that wasn't revealing itself to be that, because they often don't. There's something wrong, but, you know, who knows what.
You know, Steve, I just realized what I want out of a future version of SpinRite. I want, again, your elegant assembly code, but something that runs as a timed script in either Windows or OS 10 specifically for my SSDs. I want it to do garbage collection at 4 o'clock in the morning when I'm not awake, just because every time I start to slow down, I will pull out my copy of SpinRite and is it level one?
Level two,
where it's just, yep. It's basically going through the drive. It's not using up any of my writes unless it needs to actually destroy something. And it's just looking at what garbage collection has not yet been done. I tell you, you've saved a couple of my Samsung SSDs from the brink of death, and you've definitely improved my performance. So personally, I thank you.
Well, thank you. And we had a story just last week about exactly that. Some guy's machine was just not running well and fast. And it was an SSD-based system, ran spin right across it, and it was snappy as ever. So there again, you know, even solid-state memory. Unfortunately, the marketing pressures have pushed the density as like to the point where it's good enough, but there just isn't any tolerance. You know, that the old engineering margin has just been squeezed out. So, I mean, it's inevitable, but it's unfortunate.
Right, right. And
good news is we have a solution.
If you could get a version of SpinRite that runs on my Android phone, because I'm pretty sure that memory has not been leveled at all. That's horrible. All right, Steve, big story. Big story for us. And for the people in the chat room and the longtime listeners of Security Now, they've followed this saga a little bit. We all know that a while back you raised the alarm that there might be some weirdness going on at grc.com, maybe some cross-site scripting, and you've put on the propeller hat and figured out exactly what was happening.
Well, so what happened was a couple of weeks ago, someone tweeted me, someone using the Twitter handle TBMNull said, it was a short tweet, XSS vulnerability found at GRC, and then a link to a site called openbugbounty.org, www.openbugbounty.org, which is where this person was apparently very active, because I looked at the cross-site scripting problems he had reported, and they're all over the place. So he didn't single me out. I think he's a white hat hacker who's decided to take it on himself, take on the mission of finding vulnerabilities in websites and reporting them. He made some money from me. It's a voluntary payment, but I wanted to thank him for bringing this to my attention and for everything that transpired, because I ended up with something that I think will be very valuable to a subset of our listeners, arguably anyone who has responsibility for a website. So that page didn't show me what the problem was. I had no idea where there was a problem. The fact that this person, this TBM null, had reported so many caused me to give it some credibility. But so, okay, what did he find? So the first thing I did was I thought, okay, there's got to be some free or reasonably priced scanning services, sort of like Shields Up has always been for a person's ports, but this would be a service that would scan a website looking for these kinds of problems. It's got to be. And sure enough, I dug around and I found three that had the kind of the right profile. There was like a list of 11 that I found in an article, but the other eight were sort of off target. They weren't exactly what I was looking for, which was, you know, spider my site and tell me what you find. So the first one was an offering called Acunetics, and they offered both an online scan and a local Windows app, which I love the idea of being able to download an app. So this would, you know, be very useful if you wanted to scan a non-publicly facing intranet server, which an outside site could not get to, or if you just like the idea of running your own scan against your own site rather than having a third party do it. So I signed up, downloaded the the app, and they were sort of clearly in a trial mode, but it was like, okay, you know, they're saying that they're going to allow me to do scans in trial mode. One of the things that you always have to do, and it's very much like the applying for a certificate, you need to prove ownership of the site. Not surprisingly, that prevents random third parties from scanning other sites that they don't own and control and having problems revealed. So clearly a responsible scan service would require you to prove ownership. In this case, it was put a file on the root, and I did that, and it just worked. So authenticating with them, authenticating that I was the person who had control of the content of grc.com, not a problem. Well, then, okay, so their online service scans, and I don't remember now which one I did first, but I tried both, and both of them reported all kinds of horrors. Oh my God, the sky is falling. How have you not, you know, been attacked every which way from Sunday by now? What's wrong with you? But we're not going to tell you what. And I said, what? And then, you know, dire warnings, but you got to pay us. And so, which did not impress me, because the whole thing was a bait and switch. Nowhere was there any implication that we're going to frighten you, but use that to get your money, which just pissed me off. Also, for what it's worth, the local app was very poorly written. They want many hundreds of dollars a year, so it was not like it was cheap. But for example, one of the first things you learn to do when you're programming Windows is you create a UI thread that is a separate thread to run the UI. You know, for example, the DNS benchmark has one. While the benchmark's running, you can push buttons and flip pages and do all kinds of things. You know, it all just sort of works at the same time. Well, this thing had pause and stop buttons that you couldn't push when it was running, although that's a little contrary to common sense, because they don't have a UI thread, or it's not being sampled often, or I don't know what. But anyway, I ended up thinking, okay, this this is not what I'm looking for. I don't want to be told that, you know, the sky is falling, but sorry, we're not going to tell you where. Then the spam began. 4 or 5 pieces of marketing sales promotion per day from this company. So anyway, Acunetics, no. Second one I looked at was a company called Beyond Security. Now, I had an interesting problem with those guys. I was unable to authenticate without their help. They provided me a file that I drop onto my root, but they refused to see it. And I immediately realized why. And that is that from the first day of its existence, I feel like 15 years ago, the root redirects to a page called intro.htm. I don't know why. And if I were to do it again, I wouldn't. But back then, 15 years ago, it was all sort of magical and new. And I thought, oh, this will be fun. So there's a 301 redirect, which is the only response anyone gets to trying to pull GRC's root page. It doesn't deliver a default document. It bounces you to a named document. Well, apparently Acunetics knew how to follow the 301 redirect. I don't think that represents a security vulnerability, but the Beyond Security guys scanner didn't. So I was unable in the, you know, late at night, whenever this was, I was doing this, to use their service. I did send them a note, and I think they recognized me because they immediately said, oh, hi, yes, we'll authenticate you. And so I was able to use their service. I noted that their page required Flash for displaying summary graphs, which is a little disappointing because there's 3 blacked out boxes because, of course, Flash is not running without my permission on my browser.
That's the first warning flag there. Security scanner that demands you have flash. I'm like, okay.
They're very nice people, and they were willing to work with me, but their scanner didn't find any problems. It gave my site, GRC, a 100.00 and an A-plus grade. So I thought, well, okay. I'm pretty sure there is a problem somewhere. I'm trying to find it. So far, one service says, oh my God, how is their server even up? But we're not going to tell you how to fix it or what's wrong without money. And then these guys, who are fabulous people, said, yeah, no problems here. Move along. Yes, nothing to see. So I thought, okay, I got to keep looking. Number three, and the third time was the charm, tinfoilsecurity.com. I am incredibly impressed with this service and with the user experience, with the user interface. It is a teaching site. It is the Security Now podcast chosen website security scanner until further notice. I'm sold. Now, their authentication, as with Beyond Security, would not allow a resource on the site to be seen. So they're also not following a redirect to my intro page, which is my nominal home page, but they offered one additional means. I could put a text record in my DNS, and it's like brilliant. So that demonstrates I'm controlling the domain of grc.com, which is tantamount to controlling the server. So they gave me a blob of nonsense. And as I was talking about earlier, I updated the grc.com zone with that text record and then informed level 3's DNS servers that I had a new zone. They grabbed it. And then I said to Tinfoil, I clicked the OK, authenticate me. And they said, yay, you're authenticated. So now they knew that I was in control and the person I had, the account that I just created was there. They offered a single domain 90-day trial. It's a 3-month trial, which I think is generous. And believe me, I'm sold. And so here's the details. Their report found 64 problems. Now, okay, that's, and I'm going to go through them real quickly. They're finding things that are good to know, but they're not cross-site scripting or cross-site request forgery problems or anything, but useful. Our listeners will get a kick out of some of them. But this is the kind of thing where I'd rather have too many than to be told, oh, that you get an A+, nothing wrong. So because you can always look at them and go, okay, I know about that. That's not a problem. So most of them were informational. A couple were low impact. And then there were some that they thought were high impact. For example, I was notified, one of them, they called it credit card number disclosure. And sure enough, their spider found a string in my PDP-8 source code listing, which I have on my PD8 pages, 4207 space 0610 space 0000 space 0013. That's a credit card, except it's also Octal and it's machine language.
Actually, but I think that's like, Leo's credit card. Amazon.com.
So, maybe they're smart enough to know that the first digit has to be a 4. That's actually one of the leading digits for credit cards. But I was impressed. It was like, okay, if I actually did have a credit card flapping in the breeze, I'd want to know this thing would have found it for me. In this case, it wasn't a problem. They also identified 10 instances of what they called missing sub-resource integrity protection. Now, I should explain that with every one of these, there it's itemized. You can click on that item. It takes you to a page that completely breaks it down, shows you where it was, what the query was, what the response was, what they matched on, and what it is they think it means. So, for example, in this case, they said all externally loaded resources must have their content pinned by using the sub-resource integrity mechanisms provided by modern browsers. This involves computing a hash of the contents of the resource and specifying this hash when loading that resource. In the case of a script, this might look like the following. And they give you a sample of, like, here's what we mean, where they show include.js being loaded from example.com, and then the integrity is an SHA-256 following. And so the point is that this is your declaration of exactly the code you are pulling from some remote site that you don't have explicit control over. So this is your way to tell the browser, make sure no one has messed with this. If you get it and load it into the web page, hash it and make sure the hash balances. Otherwise, don't. So great advice. And there are a couple places where on my side, I am pulling something from somewhere and they saw that. And it's like, bravo to these guys. Again, another nice piece of information. They also found 14 email addresses. And I thought, what? Well, it turns out in more than 11 years of Security Now transcripts, some email addresses for one reason or another have been put in the transcripts. It found them all. It went through every single Security Now transcript and said, hey, you got some email addresses here. You sure you want to expose those to the public? Again, not a problem, but very nice to have something with a push of a button that, you know, can go find those for you. And this was interesting. It found there are two problems, which it called found robots.txt. And I thought, well, yeah, of course, I have a robots.txt to keep spiders from getting lost in my dynamically generated code. And so when I clicked on it, they said, if you require it, try not to list important files or directories in robots.txt. Instead, password protect them such that even if they are crawled, the crawler gets nothing but an authentication page. A good robots.txt file includes content like image directories or locations that are generated dynamically and do not work if a search engine accesses the page, but does not include administrative areas or server logs. And so I think that's sort of a generic comment that they make when they, you know, sort of like, here's a tip for like tightening things up on your site. Again, a nice observation. They found 7 things they called an HTML object. And I do have HTML native video players, for example, on the various PDP-8 pages and on a couple of the SpinRite pages. And so their comment was, this is nothing to be concerned about at the moment. As we are purely providing it for informational purposes, it often gives the hacker a beachhead of where to begin searching for a vulnerability, but isn't a vulnerability in and of itself. They reported 4 insecure cookies, saying, set the secure flag in the cookie such that all cookies are served over secure channel like HTTPS only. If you tell us that if you tell us what software stack you are running on your website, we'll be able to give you more detailed results on how to fix this issue. You can do this from your dashboard. And then there's a link there to the dashboard, which is their online configuration tool. Oh, I should say, by the way, you can dial how aggressive you want the spider to be. I think it defaulted to 50 simultaneous requests. I push it up to 100 just because I have a fast server. But I mean, it did. I could tell when it was on the site. It was sucking everything out. But again, if you want a less aggressive spidering, you can ask for that too. It also noted non-HTTP only cookies 4 times. Set the HTTP only flag in the cookie such that cookies cannot be manipulated via client-side code like JavaScript. If you tell us what software stack you're running, blah, 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 we'll tell you how to fix it. Again, the whole experience is hand-holding, explains what's going on, and where they can, gives you samples and fixes. And I should mention, the only place I use cookies is in that, and they're crazy named cookies. I don't do it for any sort of login state ever. Even my e-commerce system does not main state using cookies. It encrypts a blob of current transaction state and returns it with each phase of the transaction. And no one has that the decryption key but the GRC server. So even there, I don't use cookies. The only place I do is in the cookie forensics research that I did when we were finding bugs in cookie handling years ago in browsers. And so the reason I've got cookies is just as instrumentation probes, essentially. And they're right. There's no reason I don't have them marked secure because now GRC is all secure. I just never went back and retrofitted it. But here's a reminder that it's like, okay, that would be a good thing to do.
I've been looking through their site as you've been talking, and I love the fact that they separate issues from potential exploits. I think that's very important for someone who's just scanning their page, and then they're not going to freak out. And then I love the fact that you can drill down on the individual issues to see exactly what they're talking about. And, you know, honestly, I'd never thought about that with robots.txt. Yeah, properly formatted robots.txt files tell someone who might want to exploit my site exactly where I don't want them to go.
Right.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so the last of the insignificant things was 16 what they called private IP address disclosures. And again, given the nature of my site, you can imagine. And in fact, on the intro page to Shields Up, I say you should be aware that scanning probes will come from this range of IPs, from this IP to this IP. So there's two, you know, there's two IPs. So they said these were, again, I'm saying in Security Now podcast transcripts. And then they said remote private IP addresses from the body of HTML pages. And they wrote these can often be left over from testing and may indicate that your website is not running in the environment it expects. These IP addresses also give information to an attacker that can be used as a beachhead for other more harmful actions. So again, you know, if you don't have reason to know that you've got IP addresses exposed, that's something good to know. But they did find 3 things. That one was a false positive, but I loved that they flagged it. On the GRC fingerprints page, I provide a field that allows someone to fingerprint the certificate of any domain they choose, of any site they wish. And what they flagged it as a potential cross-site request forgery, saying it was due to no replay protection, meaning that their advice on that said that it would be possible for some entity to resubmit that form in the future because there was no like a serial number embedded in the post data that the page was placing in front of the user and that the user was then sending back to the server. And that's true, but that isn't an issue here. I do show the domain name in a I displayed the domain name back to the user, which is sort of scary because anytime you display something the user provided, that's the big danger. When we've talked about things like, you know, SQL injection attacks or cross-site scripting, like, for example, a forum back in the days before forums were carefully filtering what users submitted and they posted, when the forum puts up on the display what somebody has submitted, well, if they submitted something malicious and it was left intact, that would be displayed and then potentially running in the user's browser. So, but in this case, I carefully parse out the domain name from whatever the user provided, and I have a zero tolerance policy. And so I tried to like mess with it and get something through and was unable to. And nobody thought that was a problem anyway. However, they found four URLs in the discussions client, essentially. You know, GRC, as I've often talked about, has old school NNTP server where we have a bunch of discussion groups. That's where I'm working on. That's where all the work on Squirrel has gone on. It's where I will be returning to Spinrite to work with a community of people testing and asking for thoughts as I move forward. It's a huge resource for me. We have a read-only facility, which allows people who just want to browse what's going on, that's always been there, which I did not write. It used to be called DNews Web, and their server was awful. So I had purchased it years and years ago, and I abandoned it and switched just to, you know, free BSD Unix and a real INN internet news server. But I kept their little web front end because it was just a handy means to allow people to browse. Well, it turns out that it has a facility to allow people to kind of log in. They can identify themselves. I don't use that, but what it's called a U tag, a user tag. And once you provide that, it goes in the form. And then in order to link successive browsing together, every response returns it. And it's not filtered, meaning that anything you put in the U tag will be found and returned. And so if something malicious were put in there, then that would come back and potentially be executed by the browser. So there are four instances of that. The bad news is I didn't write that little, I mean, it's an inelegant piece of code. It's big and it's an XE and it sometimes misbehaves, but, you know, it hasn't caused us any problems. The problem is without source, I can't fix it. And so it technically represents a problem. So what I did was I wrapped those pages in what's called content security policy, CSP. Content security policy can be delivered either as reply headers or response headers in the page where they're metadata that is not seen, or in the actual HTML headers of a page. And essentially they control what the browser will do. Without any content security policy, because we need to be backwards compatible, everything is wide open. So there is no control. But you can add these CSP, the content security policy rules, which will restrict what can be done. So for example, now all of those browser pages, every one of them has a header which is incredibly restrictive, just enough for the page to work. I said, I allow images to come from GRC. I allow CSS. I'm blanking. CSS. style sheets. I allow the GRC style sheet and images and text, but like nothing else. No script, because this thing does not need scripts. No inline scripts. No child frames. No fonts coming from anywhere else. No media, no other objects, and so forth. So it is just, it's completely locked down. It's not as nice as being able to filter it, but you know, I don't want to take the time to wrap that in my own code to provide a filter or to write one myself, and I've got work to do. So that solved that problem. But the so those things it found, and then finally they found what the attacker found, and there actually was a problem. Again, in the particular case of GRC, it wasn't mission critical because I don't have any cookies of any value. And it's hard to see how this would actually get exploited. But under the support page or sales support, I allow a user to put a their SpinRite purchase transaction ID in to a form and basically make a database query. We look up that record for them, which then allows them to they get download links if they want to download another copy of SpinRite or they want to print out another copy of their purchase receipt or whatever. If their transaction was ID was not found, I was providing them the service of returning the form, saying that we did not find your transaction ID, and populating the field with what they provided. That's dangerous because user-provided data is being returned without filtering to the site. That is, you know, to their browser. So, and what this white hat hacker found was that there was a clever way of escaping HTML characters such that he was able to insert inline script in the form field. You actually couldn't do it in the field because I had restricted its length. But a spider could do an automated posting that would have no length restriction because it wasn't being enforced by the page UI and get their script to execute in the GRC domain of the user's browser. And you don't want that to happen. Because if I were, for example, maintaining state, like session state in a cookie, script running on a page from GRC is trusted. And it would have access to, if my cookies were not marked HTTP only, which is the other thing these guys found, it would have access to cookie contents and could then, for example, generate a URL query to a malicious site with that cookie the name and value embedded in the query tail and thereby exfiltrate data that was meant to be private between the server and the person looking at the page. So I was delighted to find this, and I immediately fixed it. The standard best practices says that less than, greater than, ampersand, double quote, single quote, and forward slash are dangerous. You cannot allow those to come to the browser unescaped. And so the update I made a couple weeks ago was when it is to have a safe HTML send function that this and anything else that sends data back to the user runs through. So for example, it converts an actual less than symbol into the ampersand semicolon, which the browser displays as less than, but which doesn't trigger script execution. It's not like the angle brackets containing the word script. And I also added content security policies just as belt and suspenders as well. And I notified the hacker. I thanked him. He mentioned that he'd be willing to accept a little donation in thanks. And I treated him very well with an Amazon gift certificate, which is the means that he suggested. And in the process, I found an online website scanning service that, based on all of my experience and even the experience of looking at the competition, I can recommend without hesitation, tinfoilsecurity.com, 30 days for free. 3 months. Yeah, 90 days, 3 months trial, 100% functional and much more comprehensive than anything else I have found. If you are responsible for a website, I don't know what you're doing still listening to this podcast. Sign up, have them scan your site, and then browse through the results. There's no way, based on what I've seen, they could ever be happy, which is what you want from something checking your site to make sure you haven't had any oversights. So bravo to Tinfoil Security.
Steve, talk about burying the lead. This should have been at the top of the show, because this is a practical example of so many things that you've talked about over the years on Security Now. This is you finding a vendor that you trust. This is you finding a couple of vulnerabilities within your own site, mostly because
I know more than I did before.
Precisely.
Yeah, it educated me.
This was your Iliad and your Odyssey all rolled into one, and thank you. And this is something I'm hoping that we hear from more podcast celebrities and more big websites, because I think the more that you disclose about the vulnerabilities that you find, the more people are secure, the more that they'll patch it in their own instances, their own services.
Right.
Yeah. Of course, we have gone way over time, which that's actually pretty normal for Security Now.
We broke our record, I'm sure, Father.
No. Actually, the two of us still own a record. I think we went 240 something on one.
Okay, we're at 224 right now.
224, and they actually restructured the schedule so that we can't break our record without really messing up the shows behind us. So
we're not going to do that.
I don't know. We're not going to do that. But of course, Steve Gibson, you're going to find him every week here at 1300 Pacific time, or 1330 Pacific time. He is our security guru. You're going to find him at grc.com, where you can also find transcripts and audio versions of this show. We do Security Now here on the Twit TV network normally with Leo Laporte, but I'll be subbing for him while he is looking for the Holy Grail.
Two more times.
Exactly. And I'm very much looking forward to it. And don't forget that you can find all of the back episodes. If you need to replay, and trust me, there's no dishonor in having to replay it, because Steve is pretty condensed in the information that he gives to us. You can always go to his show page at twit.tv/SN. That's for Security Now. There you'll find all of the back episodes, as well as ways to subscribe to get the show automatically downloaded into your device of choice. Of course, you can also find Security Now wherever fine podcasts are aggregated. Steve, would you like to say some final words of wisdom before we send the internet back into the ether?
I think you've got it covered, Padre. It was a pleasure working with you for the last 2.5 hours, and we'll do it again next week.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Steve. And on a personal note, I do have to say this, and this will only make sense for the people in the Twit Army. I'd like to say rest in peace to Tater, and we will miss you. Until next time, I am Father Robert Ballester. He is Steve Gibson, the man himself, and we'll see you next time on Security Now.
Thanks, Padre. Security.